Welcome to the Cosmic Business Podcast. I'm Paula Crossfield, a Vedic astrologer, business coach, and CEO of Weave Your Bliss, a company with the goal to help a million spirit-led entrepreneurs build a cosmic business around their genius so that they can earn wildly well and bankroll the change they want to see in the world. A cosmic business is a new paradigm business that believes in collaboration over competition, building a business around your unique genius, aligning to the planets and your intuition, leading with your values, putting your health and the health of the planet first, treating people fairly, and building giving into your business model. Sounds fabulous, right? On this show, I will take you behind the scenes of my thriving multi-six-figure business, including strategy on closing more sales, nurturing your community online, plus astrological insights to optimize your business and life. We'll also feature conversations with spirit-led business owners, creatives, and changemakers to inspire you. I'm coming to you from our regenerative farm in rural Maine, my happy place, where we are currently creating space to welcome community for retreat and earth reconnection. Let's jump into the conversation. Hello, my friends. Welcome to this week's episode of the podcast. I'm Paula. I'm so grateful that you're here. And I am excited to share this week's episode featuring Nina Rao, who is an incredible kirtan leader who tours the world with Krishna Das. Before we jump into this episode, which you won't want to miss because we talk about how chanting, particularly to Hanuman, can support you to feel hopeful even in dark times. We talk about all the work and origins of Saving Wild Tigers, the charity that we are actually supporting in the Cosmic Business Salon, which I'm going to tell you about in a second. We also talk about what's unique about India's wildlife and makes it need support, especially right now. So before we jump into that, I am excited to announce that the next round of the Cosmic Business Salon will be taking place starting on April 22nd. This free event features powerful conversations on building your values-based, health-centered, spiritually aligned, and financially successful business so you can bankroll the change you want to see in the world. You can go and sign up for free again at cosmicbusinesssalon.com or the link in the show notes to get access to all the conversations. Okay, so a little bit about Nina Rao. She learned traditional chants from her grandfather in a village in South India when she was 9 years old, and the chants quietly stayed with her until she rediscovered chanting with Krishna Das in New York in 1996. In 1998, she met her guru, Sri Siddhi Ma, in the foothills of the Himalayas and spent time with her regularly for 19 years. Her childhood was spent living in and moving between many countries around the world, and when she settled in New York, her working life began in the banking world, moved into organizing and leading photographic wildlife safaris in Africa and India, and now, since 1996, is Krishna Das's business manager and accompanist, as well as chant leader on her own. Nina tours with Krishna Das and was honored in 2013 to accompany him at the Grammy Awards. In January of 2013, she released her debut album, Antarayami, Knower of All Hearts. Her second album, Anubhav, was released in 2018 and entirely crowdfunded. Since 1998, she has supported conservationists in preserving the sacred wilderness and forests of India via her charity, SavingWildTigers.org, and she is a podcast host on the widely heard Be Here Now Network, exploring spirituality, practice, and conservation of wilderness and nature. Nina regularly leads kirtan, chanting workshops, and virtual and in-person retreats in New York and beyond. So I can't wait to share this with you. We are supporting Nina's charity, Saving Wild Tigers, so we get really deep into how it started and all the details about it. So without further ado, here's my interview with Nina Rao. Hi, Nina. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Paula. Thanks for having me.
It's so wonderful to have you here because if I remember correctly, you were the first person, maybe the second person I had on the podcast. So it's been like 2.5 years and it's really nice to have you back.
2.5 years. And you've probably interviewed a bajillion people between then and now.
Yeah, we're almost to 150 episodes, or maybe we just crossed 150 once this is out. So it's pretty awesome. So thank you for being a part of the early story of the podcast. And today I'm really excited because We are running the Cosmic Business Salon, which is all about how you build your values-based, health-centered, spiritually aligned, and financially successful business so you can bankroll the change you want to see in the world. So it's really about values. And one of the things we do is we raise money for a charity every single time we run it. And this time we selected Saving Wild Tigers, which is your charity. So I wanted to bring you on so you could tell us a little bit about it. So how did it start? Let's start there.
First, can I just say how delighted I am that you considered doing this? We've known each other a long time, but and you know, there's so many wonderful causes in the world, and I'm really happy that you selected this, and we'll talk more about that. So how did it start? I would say it started back in 1985. It didn't start officially in 1985, but the seed was planted in my mind in 1985 when I went on my first wildlife safari in Kenya, in East Africa. And what happened when I went on that trip was I was traveling with my first husband, who grew up in the royal family in India. So having grown up that way, his mother learned to hunt. That was part of what a princess learned how to do. She hunted in the days that you see now only in paintings, you know, people sitting up on elephants, and they corralled tigers, and they would push them into a corner of the jungle in India, and then they would shoot them. That's what they did. But the interesting thing about that is this was when she was young. By the time I met my mother-in-law, she was a vegetarian and she was a meditator. So her sons had learned all about wildlife, because the one thing that hunters do know about is wildlife. They know how to walk around in the jungle. They understand wilderness. Their goal, of course, is to capture wildlife. So what happened in India after the Wildlife Protection Act was enacted in 1972, there's absolutely no hunting at all in India of any kind that's legal. The children that she raised were interested in wildlife anyway to photograph. So by the time I married her son and we went to Kenya, he was already so steeped in love and understanding of the wilderness that it stuck on me. You know, I was young, I was 20 years old, and I had never been in the jungle before this way. Some of my early memories and that have stayed with me over the years is swimming in the ocean and snorkeling as a child in Thailand, going to the jungle in India where my grandfather lived. It was more like an orchard, but my memories of being in nature are my strongest. You know, I don't necessarily remember museum art pieces. That's probably a fault in my mind, but that's just telling you what's close to me. When I went to Kenya, he really transmitted to me a love for wildlife in a way I'd never expected. So that was way back in 1985. And my life took a different turn. I went to college. I studied economics. I came to America. I got a job on the trading floor of a bank. And I was doing the thing that all young people do, or at least all the young people I knew did, which was to create a career for oneself. At the time, I was hanging out with a lot of people who were on Wall Street or in investment banks or that kind of thing. I did that kind of work for a while, until I realized I woke up in the morning with a feeling of dread rather than excitement to open up the, you know, Wall Street Journal. The rest of the people were very excited to wake up in the morning and read the Wall Street Journal. So I knew that this was really not my path. While I stayed home thinking about what I was going to do, because I did quit my job at the bank, a friend of my father's was going to open up a safari company, a photographic safari company for Kenya in New York. And he said to my father, he said, I just need someone I can trust and who's, you know, responsible. So my dad said, well, you know, do you want to do this instead of sitting at home not knowing what to do? That was back in 1991. All my energies got focused in this direction. So I started traveling to East Africa, Southern Africa, you know, everywhere from South Africa up to Rwanda, just go gorilla trekking, all the wildlife on the plains and in the desert and the deltas. And I spent many years traveling and doing that. And while I did that kind of work, I read a lot of books about people who were doing conservation work in Africa. simultaneously, I met Krishnadas in New York. And when I met Krishnadas and I got introduced to my guru and practice, I started going to India more and going up to the ashram and going to the temple. And so while I was traveling in India, I thought, and you know, I had traveled to many places. I went scuba diving in Belize. I had traveled to Costa Rica. I travel. I love to travel, and nature travel was a big part of my life. So going to India and seeing the tiger reserves, and I thought, wait, this is an amazing opportunity for me to do the thing that I love, which is to be in the jungle, see my guru, do my practice, be in India, which is like my homeland. It really does feel like that. But so does the Hudson Valley in New York, but that is my genetic homeland. I decided that if I did any kind of tourism in India, it would have to directly benefit the conservation of the park. Many people think that when they buy their park fees to go to a park and go on safari, that that's really all that's required. That's a little bit of it. Some of that money will go to the forest department in India. But it's not enough for what has to happen. And therefore, there are a lot of non-government organizations that work on the ground around the parks. And India had a very unique set of circumstances compared to many of the African places I went to, because there's just that much more land. Even though that's changing now in Eastern and Southern Africa, you don't have people living on the fringe of wilderness areas in the same way you do in India. You have densely populated areas living outside the wilderness areas. And I saw there was a real need for these non-government organizations to be supported for what they were doing. I thought that what I was going to do, and I was going to set up, not, I didn't even think of setting up any kind of organization. I was just going to take tours and ask people to put aside a little bit of their money to go towards the parks, to whichever NGO I was talking to. So I started to research everything. I went around India cold calling. There was, you know, there weren't websites and things in those days, so I couldn't look up, you know, Ranthambore tiger saves. You know, there was nothing to do. So I started asking people questions, and then I called and I started meeting the conservationists who were doing the work on the ground. I would go and seek them out. And one of them, one of the first people I met, was a person named Valmik Thapar, who ended up being the host for a PBS series called Land of the Tiger, which unfortunately is not available now digitally, but it was one of the most beautiful series of wildlife in India that I had ever seen. And it was based on a book that he wrote. And I had found the book. So he said to me, I'll introduce you to a bunch of people who are working all around India for various types of conservation of different areas. Come to this tiger conference, which was going to be in the year 2000. So it's 23 years ago. So meet me there and you'll meet a lot of these people. They were going to come together to talk about policy for raising the number of wild tigers in India to a certain number at that point. And it was there that I met many of the people that I work with now and their descendants, actually, because it's been that long. So my goal was that I didn't want to be raising necessarily, casting a huge net and getting small sums of money that would then require a lot of admin costs associated to it to get that money. So I was going to do it in a very specific way, raise whatever I could. And every dollar that I raised would go directly into the field project. I wasn't going to take any admin costs for myself. And so I did this on my own. And when I met Valmik Thapar, whenever that was, in whichever year that was in the early 90s, he said, create this organization, Saving Wild Tigers, just do it. He said that to me back then. And strangely enough, I just met him when I was in India in November. And I told him that I had created this. He didn't know. He just knew that.
Okay.
He knew I was active in the field, but he didn't know I'd actually created this organization. So he was really thrilled. So that's how it came about. I started taking people to India. They saw the jungles. They had been to Africa with me. So now I took them to India. And they saw that the biggest concern in India is coexistence. And that is actually the case everywhere in the world. It's not even in India. It's just India is so dense, you can feel it very strongly when you're there.
So tell us a little bit more about what is going on with tigers. What are the struggles that we're seeing right now with this coexistence? What are the issues that you're trying to address, and how are you addressing them through Saving Wild Tigers?
So, like, as I was saying before, because in India, first, I'd like to just say one thing, just so that we have a context for this discussion. India, despite the fact that it's the most densely populated country in the world at this point, it still has the greatest biodiversity on the Asian European, you know, dual continent. That has occurred in the most unbelievable, magical way. I think a lot to do with reverence for nature that's inherent in the sacred paths in India, religious and spiritual paths. But also because when the British colonized India, they enjoyed hunting. So they sort of took over the same pastimes that the royal families in India had. And so in order to hunt, you have to preserve the land. Not the way they hunt here in Texas, where you put an animal in a cage, you open the cage, and then you shoot it. That's not the way they did it. They actually went out into the jungle, and then they had other help. They had people beating drums and putting sheets and like corralling an animal, and then they would kill it. But because they needed the habitat, they kept it safe. So they didn't use it for agriculture, and certainly not for industry, which is now what threat is. Mining, agricultural lands, it's mining within the wilderness areas, because, you know, everything we do in this day and age requires minerals of some sort or the other. And the other thing that's important, so the coexistence, so there's two things that start to overlap. Wildlife needs space to live and move. Human beings need space to live and move. And our roads, unfortunately, are taking precedence over uninterrupted wilderness areas. So that's one big problem. Wildlife doesn't have the opportunity to move without tremendous threat and danger to their lives. And that especially for large mammals like elephants and wildcats and bear and things like that. And they need to move because they have to keep looking for food. They forage, they hunt, and that's how they find food. So they keep moving and to, you know, greener areas. So that's one. And the other thing is that, you know, there's also the threat of poaching. So this is us consuming things from the forest. Never mind the cutting down of trees, logging, all that kind of thing, which is not allowed in India and doesn't really happen. But there is a wildlife trade, an illegal wildlife trade, for many of the products that are derived from these wild animals, including tigers, for everything from like a rhinoceros horn is used for a dagger handle. Certain parts of the tiger are used in some types of Asian medicines, you know, that are actually illegal, but they're still using them. And they kill wildlife for it. They even have farms now that do that, where they keep tigers and bears in cages and they extract that, which is another topic altogether. But on a very simple, down-to-earth level, you have people living in villages right on the border of the park. They are subsistence farmers. They have a tiny plot of land. They have a few goats and they have maybe a cow or two. And they are susceptible to the dangers of wildlife coming out of the boundaries, because there are no walls or fences of the park, and killing their animals, you know, their little goats, their cows. And if you're elephants, then you go tromping through the fields and eat all the food that they're trying to. So you have a farm, you know what that's like. It's complicated. There are so many levels. And the other thing that happens, when that happens and their lives are hanging in the balance in that way, their love for wildlife doesn't really have a place anymore. It's really almost like it's us against them, even though they are the stewards of the wilderness areas, literally, because they live right there. The love for wildlife starts to turn into vengeance. You know, you find out about, if a tiger kills, let's say, a cow, somebody's cow, they leave the carcass there and they know the tiger is going to come back to feed on the rest of the cow, they'll poison that body so that the tiger dies.
I've seen similar things up in Uttarakhand, where I've spent a lot of time. You know, they have the leopards up there, and it's like the leopard will come into the town and eat somebody's goats or whatever, and they'll be it's the same kind of fear and also retribution to kill the leopard. So it's terrible.
It is. And so what a lot of these NGOs are doing, it's a multi-prong approach. One is to help them live a safe life. So a simple thing like building a shed for the subsistence farmer that they can bring there, because most of this happens at night, not in broad daylight, when the leopards come out or the tiger come out. Build a shed with a door that's locked so that the goats and the cows can be inside at night. It's just something that they can't afford often. So we fundraise to help them to do that so that they can have their cow, because they need to live. These people, this is their home. There are some programs in place where people are actually being relocated from either inside the park to a slight distance away, closer to the town, so that other members of the family can do other types of work rather than just working on the farm, but living in the town. They give them a home and things like that. But I think the most important thing is re-inculcating this love and reverence for wildlife in the younger generation. There's a lot of programs out there where the kids in school are actually being returned back to fables, stories of animals, but also about the truth of what, why we need to preserve wilderness, because it has everything to do with climate change, the health of Mother Earth itself, and their future. So they're educated, but, you know, in a fun sort of way with plays and stories and so on. So that's very much part of it. And also just having a very real reverence for nature. Never mind the practical use for it, but that we're all part of this one giant living organism. And that includes the forest and everything that lives within it. So, and then there's, of course, another end of the spectrum where there are actual anti-poaching patrols that are out there on foot. Now, in India, you know, we don't have weapons like we have here. Here we can walk around with a gun. It's illegal in India. So these anti-poaching patrols are like, you know, they don't have anything. The forest guards have a stick. That's what they've got. And the poachers, on the other hand, have other ammunition because they are funded by outside sources. Some of them have, you know, weapons, semi-automatic weapons. But there are also people who are just hunting in the park for subsistence food. They set traps, you know, just to catch a deer and just to eat them because they don't have anything else.
And they may catch something else in their trap.
Well, that's what happens, yeah. And then those animals get caught in the trap and then they die from the infection. And bears get caught in them. Leopards get caught in them.
So it sounds like saving wild tigers is kind of helping in many different ways. And is it fair to say that you're kind of funding these other nonprofits? Like you're kind of like funneling the money to these other nonprofits that are on the ground? Yeah.
Because I'm not able to do anything on the ground. The only thing I can do is find the people I trust and I resonate with. And, you know, there's even things like, for example, one of the things that we do is we also support another organization that's helping Asian elephants. Something that happens in India is, and this is where things get really murky. You've probably seen a parade in India where an elephant is used in ceremony, religious ceremony, or tourists, or whatever it might be. Those elephants are not raised in captivity. They're brought out of the park. And then they're used for various things. It used to be in the old days, they were used for logging. You know, they could carry timber and things like that. That's not the case anymore. But it's still part of religious ceremonies. And this poor animal is brought out of the park, kept chained for the whole year so that they can do one parade. And I know that there's a whole culture there's a whole culture of Mahouts who are raised these elephants and they survive off of that. But there's a woman now who's working with someone who's created these incredible robotic elephants that look real. So during the festival, they just take them out. They are on wheels, the elephant. But the ears flap like this, and they dress them up just the way they would a murti, for example, like if we were doing any of our Hindu festivals. And they take the elephant out there, but there's no living being that's suffering for that, but you're still honoring the animal that way. So so many different ways. And this very same person who was supporting Voices for Asian Elephants, she's creating a whole system of electronics that will stop an elephant or let the train stop an elephant, first of all, for standing or walking on train tracks, because this is what we were talking about earlier. They die. They get hit by trains because we have our transportation ways dissecting their wilderness areas. So now there is a way for even train drivers to know what's ahead in the tracks. So many things.
Well, I appreciate you sharing in more detail. So I'm curious, though, because, you know, with all these things that we see going on in the world, and, you know, it's easy to feel heartbroken. It's easy to feel like it's so hard to make an impact. I know that in starting an organization, doing give backs, this has really helped me. Like the aspect of charity has really helped me to feel like I'm making an impact. But I know you are a chanter. We chant together. You do kirtan leading. So can you talk a little bit about how practice has helped you stay grounded while there's so much going on in the world that can get us down?
I recently did a chant event, which was called Sacred Music for Sacred Forests. And we raised money. All the artists came and performed. And we raised $10,000 just doing that in a yoga studio. So people could engage in the practice, something that they love, with people that they love. And I put in the effort, other people put in the effort, and then we have $10,000 to give to these NGOs. But you know me, and you know how much my practice of chanting is my sustenance. At the concert, I thanked everybody for being there, because them being there indicates their devotion to the practice, but also to wanting to help, which is something that you're talking about as well. I recognize there are so many worthy causes, children, elderly, refugees, I mean, you name it, everything. I realize that I have to spread myself really thin. And that's not usually the advice you give to somebody, but I do. Wherever I feel I can make an impact, I try to do it, whatever little part that is. So, for example, if I go to Florida and I'm going swimming with the manatees, because I love manatees, I will give something to the organization that is helping to save manatees and make sure that they have food, because they're suffering, they're starving. I have a whole list of organizations I send money to at the end of the year that deals with other things, from veterans to everything, feeding the elderly, not wasting food from restaurants, no single-use plastics. I mean, I don't know. It's just endless, right, Paula?
Yeah.
So you just do, like, putting your awareness. And I think this is where I feel that my practice has helped me the most, is that it gives you a foundation and a safe space to go to think about these things. And then it opens up your mind. You become more expansive. You become able to hold much more. Not that I don't cry when I look at the news every morning. I do. But I also know two things. If I pray, I can help myself, and I can also help all beings, especially when you offer the merit of your practice to all beings. We are not in charge. We can't control everything, but we can do our part to make even the smallest difference, because that helps us too. And when we are in a better space, then we can actually do something. And you know, I get so much inspiration from these people who are out there in the field. The amount of work that they do to have one digit's worth of positive affirmation for the work they're doing, they have so many other problems. It's one after the other, one after the other. We see the good parts because that's what we're trying to, you know, they share that with us because we're funding that for them. But I know how distraught they are many days. And when I ask them, like, what keeps you going? And they said, well, if there isn't hope, then what is there?
Yeah, it's so beautiful. I know, just for me, I was talking to a friend yesterday and she asked me about mantra practice and how that has helped me. And I literally just, what came out of my mouth was like, without that, I would be dead. And I meant it. Like, it's fortified me in a way to, I know, like in my 20s, before I had a mantra practice, I felt the weight of the world on my shoulders and I felt just kind of intense
ennui or like a depression that was from outside. You know, it wasn't coming from the inside. It wasn't not, you know, I did have doubts about my being enough or whatever, but it was really about what's going on in the world and me not feeling like I could handle it. Right. And so without that practice, I would still be kind of struggling, I think, to just move forward, you know? And I think what else that practice has done for me is it's helped me see what my dharma is and clear the muck away so that I can actually move forward and do it. It's been essential. And then also it brings you community because then you're chanting with other people and you're connecting. And like, even if you're just, you know, showing up to practice and you don't even say anything to anyone, you're just chanting, like you feel like you're part of something that's bigger than yourself. This has been so powerful for me and helps me to kind of see more clearly what's possible.
I agree. You said the key word, which is connection. When I look out there and there's all this discussion about AI and, well, we can create a rhinoceros, you know, then you can have the same feeling of, it's not the same. It's just not the same. We need to connect energetically to the elemental forces that are around us. If we don't, is when we feel lost. We have no grounding anymore. Mantra practice helps us do that. Meditation practice, self-inquiry, any of these things. Reading stories of amazing beings who fled from Tibet and still pray for the well-being of their Chinese prison guards. Who are these beings? If we're capable of envisioning the worst things that a human being can do, can you imagine if we could visualize the great things that can happen if we just put our attention on it?
And I love the intention of being of service. And you and I both are really connected to Hanuman. And, you know, Hanuman is like, when I think of Hanuman, I think of hope, because Hanuman is, you know, he's the great hero. He has this great fortitude. He's associated with the wind. He can, you know, he has this power to move mountains. So when I feel down, when I'm like, you know, not able to function, like I'm having a hard day or something, I literally just go and listen to the Chalisa or recite the Chalisa. That's what I do to kind of fortify myself. And so I was wondering if you wanted to say anything about Hanuman. So Hanuman also is he's the emblem of service. You know, he's all about how we serve in this world. And so I feel like worshiping Hanuman, working with Hanuman is a very positive way to like rechannel that energy into how we can help in a way, you know, that's fulfilling, that's also protective of our energy and our time. So we're not like over serving others without serving ourselves. We're serving ourselves so that we are strong and fortified so that we can be of service in the best way. Does that make sense?
It's not possible otherwise. If we don't take care of ourselves, it's impossible to take care of other people in the long run. And Hanuman, the beauty of Hanuman is he's so aligned with the flow of everything that whatever needs to be achieved can be done by invoking him. And he has that siddhi, he has that power, and that comes from his innate beingness of wisdom and compassion, both things together. And by invoking him in our prayer, we ask for that clarity of discernment, intelligence, and a deep understanding and acceptance of what is, and then what is my part and how am I able to dispel the darkness and bring in the light, whatever that is that's going to improve the situation. And that's what he does in the entire Ramayana, and that's what you hear about Hanuman doing. And he does that because he's fully surrendered to that which is divine. That's the key. And the only way to reach, to even look in that direction, is to do practice. You can't will yourself into being surrendered. You can. You can keep talking to yourself and reminding yourself, well, I'll do what I can do, but ultimately, things are what they are, which doesn't mean that you don't do anything. You still have to do what is important. You have to contribute. And that's how you feel connected. That's how you help everyone. Service is what it's all about. And then we pray that everybody has that same awareness. Because imagine if everybody has that awareness to help another, it'll lift everything up.
So beautiful. Well, Nina, thank you so much for your time and sharing about saving wild tigers. And I just want to remind everyone who's listening to go and sign up to be a part of the Cosmic Business Salon at cosmicbusinesssalon.com. And this will give you a chance to listen in for free to talks that will help you build your values-based business so that you can raise money and bankroll the change you want to see in the world. And as I have said before, you will get the opportunity to upgrade, and that upgrade will be given to Saving Wild Tigers as a donation, and it will allow you to get some awesome bonuses, including a live call with me where we're going to integrate the information that we learned during the summit. You'll get an ebook with some of the major takeaways from this event, and you'll get lifetime access to all of the talks. They're very dense, so you may want to listen to them again. So make sure you grab the upgrade once you've signed up. And again, the website is cosmicbusinesssalon.com, and you can share with your friends, and hopefully we'll see you on the inside. Thanks again, Nina, for your time.
Thank you, Paula, and thank you to everyone who's listening for your support.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cosmic Business Podcast. We hope it was inspiring for you. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave a review for us so other spirit-led entrepreneurs can find out about us. I want to thank Team Podcast for production support on this podcast, as well as the musicians of the music that we're listening to now, Alexis Georgopoulos and Jeffrey Cantu Ledesma from an album Fragments of a Season, which you can check out wherever you listen to music. I hope you have a wonderful day, and I look forward to connecting with you on a future episode.